we can now continue with our Sufism. And we, just to remind you again, what we are doing here is we are basically trying to establish how to work with the mind, not how to overcome the unwholesome quality, how to build up the wholesome quality in the mind. That's what we have been doing. We're looking at how to overcome ill will and anger and the negative states of mind. We have been looking very briefly yesterday how to do death contemplation. And today I want to look at a topic which is a little bit more, maybe a little bit more advanced. I'm not sure if that's the wrong word, but a little bit more perhaps difficult for people, and that is the how to overcome some of the attachments and desire within life. And this is what this is about, this next sutta called the Kautilya Sutta. And remember that one of the instructions that the Buddha gave, and you may remember this as well from the suttas, where the Buddha says that one of the reflections everybody should do every now and again is that everything which is dear and agreeable to me must become otherwise, must be changed, right? Must become otherwise anyway. Right? So this is a very powerful instruction. Everything which is dear and agreeable to me, in other words, everything I own in this world, all the relationships I have, everything I have will eventually disappear and fade away. So, and he said that this is a reflection that everybody should do in their life, because it keeps you kind of grounded, it keeps you kind of focused on what really matters in life. And this sutta I'm going to talk about now, the Kautilya Sutta, is really like an expansion on that. How can we learn to think in such a way that we don't attach too much, we don't hold on to things too much, but we're able to let go of things a little bit more, and not have too much desire for the things of the world. So this is here explained in terms of similes. There are seven similes to make this clear. And one of the most wonderful and powerful things about the teaching of the Buddha is actually all the similes that he gives us. There are so many similes in there, and very often they are so powerful and so clear, and they really go to the heart. Sometimes if you just read dry stuff, just purely intellectual stuff, it kind of becomes superficial, but similes can often help you to take it on board in a deep way. So these are seven similes to help us how to understand the danger in attachment, the danger in too much craving, and this sort of thing. So, Kautilya. So this is the Buddha speaking, and this is just an extract from this quite a long sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Buddha says, householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So this is a simile for how to think about desire and craving in life. Right? There is a dog who is going to this butcher's shop, and of course he's probably waiting for a nice piece of meat, right? But nobody's going to throw a nice piece of meat to a dog, it's too valuable, they're going to keep that in the shop. So the dog, all it gets is some kind of skeleton, and all it has on the skeleton is some blood, right? A bit of blood. So you kind of, you gnaw this bone, you get a little bit of taste, but you get no real satisfaction. There's no real nourishment, right? And the dog kind of gnawing and biting this bone doesn't really get anywhere, gets a little bit of taste, right? And after a while he gives up and runs off to the next butcher shop, right? He does the same thing at the next butcher shop again, getting a bone and getting a skeleton or whatever. And in this way, always running around from place to place, always getting a taste, a little bit of taste, but never really getting satisfied. Craving never abating, desire never coming to a halt. Right? And this is what life is like. When you start to think about life, the desires and cravings that we have, we're always running after a new desire, always running after a new craving, trying to satisfy it. And if you look at what craving tells you, when you are in the thrall of craving or desire, then what happens? What that desire is telling you implicitly is that when you satisfy me, you will be happy, right? That's what the desire says every time. If you satisfy me, then you will be content, then you will be happy. Actually, we know already that's not quite true. That's almost like the feeling we have, right? So we pursue it, like almost like a drug addict pursuing drugs, right? Running after this, trying to satisfy our craving. And then it doesn't really satisfy again. And because it doesn't satisfy, we must run, we continue to run after the next one. So this is why...
What happens if you have a desire for learning spiritual, like listen to Dharma,
That's the desire which leads to the end of the desire, right? True, actually, there is truth about that. There are desires that lead to the end of the desire, and there are desires which just keep on. This is really about sensual desires, right? That's what this is all about, sensuality in the sensual realm, food and relationships, that kind of stuff. So there is no end to this. So what it means is that after a while, if you understand what this is about, you understand, actually, this poor dog is just suffering, right? They're just running from one place to another one, getting a bit of taste for blood, and then running on to the next drop, never being satisfied. It's really just suffering. It's restlessness. It's agitation inside. There's never any chance to really rest. Never any chance to feel, wow, now I have done my work, now I can have a holiday. That holiday never arrives. There's just more work to be done in the future. On and on and on. And we're all a bit like that. This is the problem in life. We're all like this dog. So when craving starts to go down because you're practicing the right way, you're starting to find happiness in the mind through doing the right thing. When craving starts to die down, you start to feel more satisfied. You start to feel more fulfilled inside. And if you keep on practicing the Buddhist path, and you get to the point where you get a nice state of meditation, whatever it is, maybe a state of samadhi, right? What you find is that for the first time in your life, you feel completely satisfied. There's no craving there. You feel happy. You feel complete inside. The whole. A craving is like an itch that always needs to be scratched, right? Scratching the itch. And then you stop scratching, it comes back again soon afterwards. Scratch more, and you keep on going like that. It's an itch which is always there. But for the first time in your life, you feel complete. You feel satisfied. There's nothing missing anymore. You feel like a whole person. And this is the power of letting go of all the craving and finding that sense of wholeness and completeness inside of you instead. But this is the sort of thing that you can only really understand by pursuing the meditation. When you pursue it, and one day you actually get the result, now you see, well, this is what it's like. This is what it's like to feel complete. This is what it's like not to always have to run after things. This is what the end of craving is like. Wow! It's incredibly good, it's incredibly powerful, it's very beautiful, it's a wonderful thing that happens. And then you understand, and you think about the simile of the dog, now you understand that simile fully for the first time, right? You understand what it means to never be satisfied, always running around, always be restless, always be agitated as a consequence of this. So, that is the simile of this poor dog which never finds satisfaction. The sensual realm, there can never be any final satisfaction. Yes, sir?
Good morning. So the counter effect of the way to counter craving is to feel a sense of contentment.
Yes, that is right. That's exactly right. So contentment and craving are exact opposites. Contentment means precisely no craving. Yeah.
How do we actually cultivate contentment within us?
Okay, so
there's a shortcut.
Yeah, shortcut. There is no shortcut. It is just the eightfold path. That is the only cut there is. Short for long for medium. The eightfold path cut. Whenever you hear the word shortcut, oh, it's a bad word.
I always remind myself, is it a need or is it a want?
Is it a need or is it a want? Right.
Our needs are few, our wants.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's nice. You're saying, is it a is it a need or is it a want? And you're looking after your need, but you're not worrying so much about your wants. So much anyway, yeah. But what's about your need? Okay, good, yeah, that's a nice way of thinking about it. But remember that a lot of this is just about, one of the things that we're doing here is that we're trying to find some spiritual happiness in our lives, right? And that spiritual happiness always counteracts the craving. So whatever you do, like create the happiness that comes because you're living the Eightfold Path, you're living the life of a Buddhist, all that happiness goes directly against craving. Because the spiritual happiness is in the present moment. It's not about the future, not about the past. If you think, wow, you know, I've been doing all these good things, and then you feel a sense of joy because of that, well, that joy counteracts the craving straight away. This is why the spiritual joy is such a foundation factor when we practice meditation practice. That spiritual joy will bring you into the present moment. And when you have that glue in the present moment, then meditation becomes possible. So this is why virtue, kindness, generosity, compassion, all of these things are so important. Not just because you have to do them because you're a Buddhist, right? I'm a Buddhist, I better do it because I'm a Buddhist. No, it's because ultimately it actually takes away the pain in your life, takes away the problems, and it builds up happiness for you instead. That is the ultimate purpose of these things. Remember the first sutta I read out on this little retreat? I talked about the various factors leading up to samadhi and seeing things according to reality. And the very first factor was sila, right? That's the first factor. When that is practiced rightly, no regret. When you have no regret, you have pamuja, which is gladness. So gladness comes automatically from sila, and practice sila in the right way. And that makes the craving die down. Now, these similes here, the things that I'm reading out here, are also helpful, because if you understand the danger in craving, that also helps to die down a little bit, right? So the more you reflect on this, the more you understand that actually it isn't so great after all. That reflection also helps you to reduce the craving. It naturally gets reduced. The thing you shouldn't do is kind of use force. I must not crave, right? Craving is bad. I'm a bad Buddhist or whatever. That is not going to work yet. Reflect on these in a natural way, and reflecting on them in a natural way will have consequences. And one of the consequences will be that you crave less simply by doing the reflection. If you reflect properly, right? Of course, there are wrong ways, there are good ways of reflecting. If you reflect in the right way, it will work. This is what the Buddha says. He always says this. This is actually the suttas, you know, we're supposed to let go. And people say, but how do you let go? I can't let go. Well, the way you let go is to understand that the thing you're holding on to actually is a problem. It's suffering. If you understand that something is suffering, you let go. You don't hold on to it anymore. Yeah? So if you understand that craving is a problem, that's how you let go of things. And then you have something else inside of you, all the things you have developed, so you have a happiness inside that you can return to instead. Okay, first simile. The simile of the dog. Second one. Actually, the Buddha first said, first of all, I didn't read out, he said, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. It's very hard to see these things, because most people are immersed in the world of sensual pleasures, of things they own and all this kind of stuff. These things are very hard to see fully. You can get a little bit of a glimpse of what this similes mean. We all understand it to some extent, but the full understanding only happens when you go above them and you get to a state of samadhi. Ideally, you become an Aryan who sees these things clearly there. So the purpose here is not to force you in any one way, it's just to give you something to reflect on. Simile number two. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away. And then other vultures, other herons, other hawks pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder? If that vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is greater. So what is going on here? What is going on here? The peace of need, that is like something you have attained in your life, something you have got, right? Some possession, some relationship, whatever it is. This is like the peace of need, all the things that we own in the world. The problem is that if there is so much competition for the things that we own, there's competition for partners, competition for girlfriends and boyfriends, competition for the jobs, competition for the salaries. When you're a child, you compete for the last piece of cake, you know, you compete for who can use the toy, who can use the PlayStation or whatever. Everything is about competition. So these other hawks, these other birds, they come. They also want that piece of meat, right? In the animal world, it's much rougher than in the human world. In the human world, okay, if you've got a piece of meat, I'm not going to take it away from you. I'm going to leave it. You can have it. You can have that piece of meat. That's usually how it works in the human world. We don't usually steal things straight away. But in the animal world, much more brutal. So you follow after that bird, you kind of rip that piece of meat out of the beak or out of the claws or whatever. Yeah? Human life is also, to some extent, a bit like that. All the competition we have. The cake, the economic cake, is only so large. If somebody else gets a larger piece of the economic cake, it means it's less for us sometimes. Sometimes, hopefully, the cake grows, right? So everybody gets a bit more, but very often, there's only so much to share out. And because of that, we compete over things, and we fight over things. And sometimes the fighting is desperate. You get thieves stealing things from you, and all this kind of stuff. So this is the other thing why life sometimes, in the realm of sensuality, there's often so much conflict, right? You can see that one of the things that is being pointed out here is that sensuality leads to conflict almost always. Precisely because we are competing against each other. The whole idea of the capitalist economy is based on competition, right? And because it is based on competition, I think conflict is also comes very soon behind that. Capitalism also involves a certain degree of conflict as a consequence, a certain degree of fighting, of problems because of that. So this is, I think, one of the kind of inherent problems in some of these economic systems. So when you give up all that desire, you give up all of that, and you're just content with what you have inside of yourself, and your own samadhi, whatever it is, then of course that conflict also dies away as a consequence. So I think this is one of the very important things to understand, is how sensuality is very closely connected with anger and with ill will, etc., etc. Okay, let's have a look at the next simile. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. The sensual pleasures are like a grass torch. What does that mean? How can sensual pleasures be like a grass torch? What is actually going on here? And what is going on here? One of the important things to understand about sensual pleasures, the word here is karma chandana. Is that it refers to two quite different things. It refers, first of all, to the desire that we have inside of us. That's one aspect of sensuality. We desire things in the world, right? But it also refers to all the objects in the world. All the objects we amass, all the objects we want to have, you know, the nice car, the whatever it is that we have in our lives. All of that is also called karma in Buddhism. So both the person of desire and also all the objects that we attach to and that we desire. Now what this is saying is that the reason is that when we attach to things, and we attach to so many things, one of the most strongest attachments often to people, right, to relationships, but sometimes also to possessions. Whenever you attach to something, you are asking for trouble. Why? Because you know that that attachment would be challenged by the laws of impermanence. Before you know it, impermanence is going to say, take it away, right? You're attached, tough luck. And how do you feel when that happens? You suffer. This is the whole purpose. So when you assume that you're attached, you're saying, now I know I'm going to suffer in the future. It's like you have set up the system in such a way that you know that suffering must happen as a consequence. This is what he's saying here, the grass torch, right? The grass torch are very useful, the grass torch, because it gives you a bit of light, you can see where you're going in the darkness. But of course, the grass torch is also very dangerous, because the wind comes, blows back all the embers or whatever from the grass, and it sets you on fire, and then you burn. So as soon as you grasp that grass torch, in the same way, as soon as you grasp and attach to possessions, to relationships, you're asking for trouble, and you're asking for suffering in the future. At the very latest, you're going to have to pay back at the time when you die, at the very latest. Then is when everything is challenged. And this is why, one of the reasons why death is often very difficult for people, because everything is challenged, right? Obviously, all your relationships, your family, your friends, everything, all your possessions, obviously. Your body, right? We're often very attached to our body. Hopefully, when we get very, very old, we start to detach a little bit. But usually, we are very attached to our bodies. And not only that, but also our position, right? Our social position, our education, all of these kind of things. They are also connected to this world. So all of that, when you die, you don't have much left, right? All you have left when you die is your mind. And that mind, if you have developed a beautiful mind in this life, you take with you something beautiful. You take with you gold into your next life. That is why it is so powerful, so important. Develop this mind. It's the only thing we can take with us into the future. So every time you're attached, you're saying, give me suffering, basically. That's what you're saying there. But of course, we can't avoid that. We can't really avoid attaching, right? So this is the other thing. That doesn't mean you should try to be some perfect Buddhist again who never attaches. I'm a Buddhist, I should attach less, right? Sometimes you hear people say that. Well, you can't really choose these things. You can't just stop attaching. Because it's according to nature. We have to attach. This is an aspect of the sense of self. As long as you have a sense of self, you will desire, you will crave, you will attach. Because the sense of self owns things. That's one of the purposes, or one of the functions, or one of the outcomes of having a sense of self. You always own things, you own relationships, you own stuff. So you can't avoid that. So don't try to be too perfect, because all you do is create more suffering for yourself. Instead, understand the danger, and then slowly move away from that. And as you build up more happiness in your life, as you build up the happiness elsewhere in your meditation practice, just by being kind and a good person, then the attachments decrease all by themselves, quite naturally. You can see that somebody who is very happy, some people who are very, very happy in this world, they have very much less attachments than other people. And that is consequence. Happiness equals less attachment. Okay, that is the simile of the grass torch. Now we come to another simile. Oh, yeah, this one is a very, very powerful one. Perhaps this is probably one that's most difficult to understand. Householders, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals, without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way or that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, for the danger in them is great. That's pretty powerful stuff, right? It's almost very hard to really relate to because it's so strong. Sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit. Imagine that somebody wants to give you a nice new car, a nice new BMW, and you say, no, keep it away, too dangerous, right?
Right.
Or you have some nice relationship, you have a wonderful man and wonderful woman, and no, stay away, don't want, you know, please, but chuckle fit. So, it's very hard to understand, right? It is so profound, it's very, very deep. And the only way that you can understand this is, well, the only way really is that if you are a Buddhist, you say, okay, well, if the Buddha actually said this, and maybe it is true. I don't know it yet, but maybe there is some truth to this, and I will just allow it to be for now at the back of my mind, and maybe one day I will understand what is going on here. But there is a sutta elsewhere called the Magandhya Sutta, where the Buddha kind of explains how this is possible. And what he says has a similarity. I'm not sure if I have it. Do I have it here? Later on? I'm not sure if I have it too. No, I haven't. Okay, I haven't too. So this is a sutta where the Buddha says that it is like a leper, right? When you are attached to sensual pleasures, you are a bit like a leper, says the Buddha, right? So what he says is that if you are a leper, is somebody who has all the sores over the body, right, and sometimes they get infected by maggots, all kinds of things, and because it is so painful, because it's so itchy, for the leper goes to a fire, and he or she burns their limbs on that fire, because it is so painful and so itchy, the sores they have on their body, right? And then the Buddha says, well, when if somebody comes and treats that leper, and afterwards they are free of that leprosy, would they still go to that fire and burn their hands? Of course not. And then the Buddha said, well, was it just, you know, that fire, is it only hot now, or was it hot also before? It was hot also before. So what is going on? What is going on is that when you have leprosy, your sense faculties, your experience of the world is distorted. You can't see clearly, right? It is so distorted that even though the fire actually is hot, to you experience it as pleasure, right? This is what's happening with the leper here. And he's saying it's exactly the same thing with ordinary people. He's saying that this is why this is so hard to understand, right? He's saying that it's exactly the same with ordinary people. Although sense pleasures, sensual objects of the world actually are painful from the Buddha's point of view, because our outlook is so distorted, it feels like it's happy. So this is very, very powerful, a very strong kind of simile that the Buddha is using here. And I wouldn't, I don't want to stress the point too much, maybe I've stressed it too much already, but just keep it at the back of your mind. This is how the Buddha teaches. Okay, let's see what happens. Let's practice and see if there might be some truth to this. Don't kind of make it into too much of a problem. Yes?
Let's check. What about people with addictions?
Yes.
Like drugs or alcohol or that. They know it's not so good for them, but
well,
they just can't control it.
Yeah, it's a similar kind of thing, right? It's a similar kind of situation. Or like smoking, right? Smoking cigarettes. First time you smoke, it's terrible. Have you smoked beforehand? Have you had a cigarette beforehand? Never had a cigarette? Whoa. I remember smoking, but I didn't smoke regularly. I had occasionally, I would smoke a cigarette. It was absolutely terrible. It was horrible. But after a while, you get addicted to the nicotine, and you have to have it, right? Even though it is not really nice, it's just the addiction that you have to get over. And this, I think, is much of what sensual pleasures is about as well. It's like an addiction, and you have to have your fix, right? Craving is there. And a lot of it is not actually so much the desire for happiness. A lot of it is just the desire to get rid of the craving, because the craving is painful. This is one of the reasons why, you know, why we pursue these things, because the craving itself, the desire is painful, you want to get rid of it, that is a large part of why sensual pleasures are pursued so much. But yes, it's a bit like addiction, basically, this is the kind of thing here. Is that what you meant?
No, I mean is that, well, if a person knows that this addiction is no good, but they can't get out of it because of the conditioning. So how do you overcome all this?
Well, just the same way we overcome the addiction of sensual pleasures. You have the same kind of thing, right? You have to understand the danger in that. It's easier to overcome addiction to alcohol or drugs or cigarettes, easier, because once you overcome it, once you get it out of the system, it's kind of gone, right? This is a much more deep-seated kind of addiction to sensual pleasures. So the way is, yes, you understand that it is dangerous. Once you understand it deeply enough, the motivation arises, just like the motivation to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Motivation. Once you are motivated, you can overcome almost any addiction in your life. But you have to find the motivation first. Yes?
I'm trying to equate
mental happiness to spiritual happiness. Spirituality in Buddhism can be defined spirituality.
Well, spiritual happiness is all the happiness that you get from basically living a good life, right? So whenever you feel happiness and joy because you've been doing the right thing, that happiness and joy is spiritual happiness.
So it's the same as mental happiness?
Yes, roughly the same as mental happiness.
So what about spirituality?
What do you mean?
Spirituality, how does Buddhism define spirituality?
Well, spirituality just means instead of living for material goods, living for the material things of the world, you live for the happiness and the joy of the heart instead, of the mind. That's spirituality. Yeah. You're living for that. Something like that. Yes.
Following up from her question. In a situation where someone is very concerned, you indeed can. They will
require more to get rid of the pain. Yeah. So it's like
from one hot
pot
into another hot
pit.
So how can someone actually put this teaching
into
this
device? You mean what, can you get
an addicted
to it?
Is
that what you mean? Or
after some time, the patient is getting addicted to it.
Yeah.
So the doctor gives him morphine shots and
gets maybe a
stronger dose.
I don't think it is such a massive problem because a lot of that addiction would be like a physical addiction. It's related to the physical body. When you die, you get rid of the physical body. The addiction itself is very likely also to disappear. So I don't think it's such a major problem because it's related to the to these things. I think it's I don't think it's so bad.
If there's no addiction, like for example, if there is a BMW.
Yeah.
I want more, many
BMWs,
but one
BMW
is make our life very happy.
You see, this is the problem, right? I was so happy with the BMW, right?
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah.
Then you got somebody
you
got stolen.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, then, you know, remember, I'm not saying that there is no happiness. There is happiness, right? Of course there is happiness there. I know what you mean. You see a BMW, you see, wow, that's a nice car, whatever. Of course, there is some degree of happiness there. I fully agree with you. The point is that from a higher level, it looks different. So it's just like the leper. Of course, the leper, actually, there is some happiness for the leper when he puts the hand into the fire, right? There's some kind of happiness there. But from a higher level, dukkha, it's exactly the same thing. So yeah, no, it's not just suffering, I agree with you.
Leper story, yeah. I remember it this way, Monday. The leper has all this sore itch pain, so he puts it to the fire.
Yeah.
The fire, he feels good when he puts it at the fire. Yeah. Then he puts it longer and then he gets more sauce from the fire later on. But the momentary joy from the fire.
Yeah.
So momentary joy.
Yeah.
So he puts it at the fire longer.
Yeah.
But later on, the sore gets worse, Parts of it get burned, and the sore gets worse.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes we have momentary joy from what we get.
Yeah.
The momentary joy. And sometimes we don't mind suffering the momentary joy. Later on, more suffering, but for that momentary.
It gets worse. If you indulge too much in your craving, craving gets even stronger, right? It gets even worse. Just like you're saying, like the leper put in his hand, that's true. Yeah.
My husband has a friend who has a very expensive car, I don't know, 7 series BM or whatever. And then when, because of that car, Bandai, they used to go out for lunch break, enjoy just stopping here and there for lunch. But because of the car, he has to park in very secure hotel parking. So that becomes a burden too. He's worried that he gets lost.
Yeah. He should get in the second car, kind of cheap, old, beat up car, use that when he wants to go out. The BMW will get me in the garage all the time. He owns it, This is what happens, I know the feeling. Also, when you are very wealthy, you have to have lots of security and all kind of things, and you are worried about other people taking advantage of you, right? Exactly. All these kind of things. If you're a monk, people can take whatever they want. No problem, please. You can have an alarm clock if you want it. But it's actually very nice, but sometimes not having things actually unburdens you, and this is what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay, very good. Which one is first? Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
desire for attachment.
Yeah.
What about our attachment with our children?
Yeah, okay.
That's hard, right?
Yeah. It's okay. You know, I'm not saying you should have that attachment. What I'm saying is that if you understand the danger in these things, your mind will tend to move a little bit away from that. That's all. I'm not saying you should. It's not should here. It's just a matter of understanding. And then when you practice the palm, the attachment decreases. But the thing is that with children, you will always have some attachment. It's very unlikely you'll get rid of it all anywhere now. But what you can do is you can reduce the attachment a little bit. And then when your child is always, sometimes you'll be very happy with your child, otherwise it's going to do stupid things, right? And if you have less attachment, it hurts you less when the child does stupid things. Guaranteed, child is going to do stupid things, right? It's absolutely guaranteed. Always going to disappoint you to some extent. Sometimes make you happy, sometimes disappoint you. So by having that attachment, it means you are protecting yourself from the suffering that comes from that kind of disappointment. Then you can look at your child and you can say, okay, this is the way the child has come into this world, maybe because of past karma, past personality, and all these kinds of things. Sometimes the child has to do stupid things. It's okay. And then you can think about the real benefit for the child instead of thinking about you. It's often about you. If you are attached, it's about your vested interest. I'm going to look bad if my child doesn't do the right thing, right? What are my neighbors going to think? Or something like that. And it's always a little bit like that. We have a vested interest because of the attachment. If you take away attachment, there's no vested interest anymore, and you can look purely upon what is beneficial for the child instead of your vested interest. So it's a good thing, actually. Good thing to reduce attachments a little bit. Don't worry about it. You will be okay. Yeah. The child will be okay as well. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Is there such a thing as spiritual addiction?
Spiritual addiction?
I have a friend who had good experience in a meditation course,
yeah.
And he's so careful about going for talks, going for anything about Buddhism,
yeah.
And of course, because of the shortage of time, he cannot do everything by his own.
Yeah.
He has read up the messages to a group of friends. He said, are you going there? Are you going there? So he actually sends representatives, please record this for me. and we'll share. So
okay.
The final word is sharing on caring.
Okay.
At the same time, it's becoming a form of addiction.
Yeah, okay, I see. Well, I think, you know, anything can be done the right way, anything can be done the wrong way, yeah, there's all this kind of thing, so I see what you mean there. I think to some degree there will be some spiritual addiction there, right, and that probably it's good if there's a little bit of addiction, probably good. If you're addicted to keeping the five precepts, probably a good thing, right, if you're addicted to being kind to others, then probably a good thing, yeah. But you have to be careful that addiction doesn't spill into doing unwholesome things. And if you're asking too much from your friends because of your craving, this is almost going into craving, right? And then it isn't really spiritual anymore. Then it becomes worldly again. So you're turning the spirituality into a worldly pursuit instead. So you have to be honest with yourself. Is it really spiritual? Or is it perhaps more worldly? As long as the addiction just keeps you doing the right thing, then the addiction is okay. If the addiction becomes so bad, it starts you doing bad things, that's when there is a problem. So, but a little bit of addiction is okay, because if you are not, you know, if you're not a little bit attached to your precepts, if there's a little bit of attachment there, it means that you will very easily break them, right? And you break them very easily. So a little bit of attachment is good at the beginning. And then as you move on, that attachment will decrease later on. Okay. So, let's just have a look at the remaining similes. I apologize for that simile. It's very, very strong, so take it too serious, just keep it there at the back of your mind to something to reflect on. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, noble disciples consider that. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. And I think this is a great simile for sensual pleasures in life. And I'm sure you can understand a little bit about what that means. Very often we dream about things, we dream about getting a new car, getting a new relationship, getting a new house. then when you get it, it is that exciting after all, right? It's exciting for a while, but it doesn't last that long. Yeah. And then you have that car for a few weeks and think, yeah, actually, maybe I need to get another one. This isn't good enough, right? Or whatever it is. It's always a dream about the future. Yeah. I remember when I was young, long time before I became a monk, maybe in my late teenage years or whatever, and I think everybody is probably the same at that age. You think about the future, right? What should I do? What kind of education should I have? What kind of girlfriend should I have? You know, should I have this kind of job? Or you have these ideas in your head that you're always very conceited when you're young, right? You have this idea that you're going to make it really big and become some kind of big shot or whatever. Yeah. All these ideas in your head, all this training. Yeah. And then you realize after a while that it's not going to happen that way, right? It's going to be very different. Your dreams and the reality are all very far apart. And then you get different dreams. You don't learn, right? People don't learn usually. So what happens, your dream just changes. You get a different kind of dream. And you dream about something else. And after a while, actually that dream too is not really going to happen, right? And so it goes on throughout your life. Look, thinking that you know where you want to go, you know where you want to be, it's all driven by craving ultimately, but never actually getting there, never really getting the result. Because the mismatch between how we look at the world and what the world really is like. Craving creates that mismatch. Craving gives you this illusion, the idea that these dreams can be fulfilled, but they can't. Dreaming is always just a dream. So, this is what sensuality, the sexual world, is like. It never really gets you where you think you want to be, and usually you get disappointed with this sense. And so this, I think, is a very powerful simile, which perhaps all of us can relate to, the idea that the reality and the dream, always different, never exactly the same. But same thing about monastic life, right? Somebody was asking the other day about their son or something wanted to become a monk. And it's the same thing, you dream about monastic life. When you get there, actually it's different, right? Even that isn't quite the same. Right? And so this is one of the reasons why craving often is so useless. Or we dream about meditation prayer. We think, when I meditate, I get into a nice state of samadhi, it will be like this. No, it won't be like that. It will be different from that. Whatever you think it's going to be, it's always going to be different. This is quoted directly from one of the suttas. That, of course, is slightly different from the sexuality, but it's a similar kind of vein. The sexuality is even more kind of deceptive. These other things, at the very least, they lead to a good result, but in the sensual world, very often they don't. You dream, you go so hard, you do everything to get these things, and then you get disappointed at the end of the day. Okay, so it is now 11:45, so we should probably stop for lunch. So have a nice lunch, and we'll see you again at 2:00.